Okay, so today I'm going to talk about hot gaseous halos around spiral galaxies, and in particular the view from numerical simulations, or at least our numerical simulations. This is a topic that it hasn't been discussed so far, at least not since I'm here at this program. It's I think also an interesting part of the connection between galaxies and halos. And here I mean the dark halos. And so this hot diffuse gas is something that we can use to learn a lot about the connection between the big potential wells in which galaxies assemble and the galaxies themselves. So because of that, I think you can view it as a key component of what I call the baryonic interface, and another term that people are more familiar with is circumgalactic medium. Of course, circumgalactic medium is a multiphase concept, and the hot phase, which I'm focusing on in this talk, is just one of the phases, and that's the one that I define up there. So it's a diffuse gas that is about 1,000,000 degrees or even higher surrounding spiral galaxies. So I'm talking about the hot halo of spiral galaxies in this talk. You know that having a hot halo in a dark matter halo, it's a generic prediction of CDM. It's one of the most direct prediction of galaxy formation inside a cold dark matter scenario. Observationally, detecting these halos around spiral galaxies has been and still is quite problematic. There are now, finally, after many years, some clear detections that typically are in this range of soft X-ray band. So they're really at the limit of what we can detect with current instrument, which is the reason why they are difficult to spot. Now, the other important aspect of studying the hot phase is that, like other phases of the CGM, it could make an important contribution to the missing baryons, which is another outstanding unsolved problem in galaxy formation. In the standard picture where you have gas accreting and shocking inside dark matter halos, you expect a hot phase to be generated exactly by gravitational heating. But of course, we know there are other energy sources in galaxy formation, feedback, different types of feedback processes. And those are probably also playing a role in generating a hot medium. So we would also like to understand the combination of these different heating sources, how they play together. And so if you turn the argument around, that means that in principle, you could also view the hot phase as a tool to study the effect of feedback, if feedback has a role in generating that, which is one of the things that we'll try to discuss in this talk. Now, concerning the evidence from data, a couple of things have to be said, because sometimes there's confusion in the literature and also in the way people use the literature data when they compare with simulations or models. And so if you look at even the recent literature of the last few years, I think that situation can be summarized in the following way. We have two lines of evidence of X-ray emitting gas, extended X-ray emitting gas, out to a few tens of kiloparsecs around spirals. And the first comes from the most interesting, I believe, in the context of this talk, which is that we have now a few examples of such halos around weakly star-forming galaxies, so normal spirals. However, these normal spirals that have been studied and for which we have clear detections are very massive spirals. They're much bigger than the Milky Way. We are talking of objects like the one that I'm reporting here from the Bogdan et al. Paper that have a circular velocity of 350 kilometers per second. So they're not the typical spiral. They're really, you know, the upper end of the spiral galaxy star mass distribution and halo mass. So for these objects, this is one example. XMM Newton data show clearly that there is a nice extended halo well beyond the limit of the optical galaxy. Now, there are also evidences of X-ray emitting gas around smaller galaxies, more normal spiral galaxies in terms of mass, but those are typically starbursts. And these are known since a long time, like Strickland et al. Already, and many other papers already more than 10 years ago, had shown examples of that, which you often have coincidence also with H-alpha. But in many of these cases, it's a very localized emission near the disk. And again, these are starbursts, so they are a biased sample. So they're not the typical object you want to use to study this hot phase. Of course, they can give some interesting information, but they are not the, I would say, the standard ruler that people should use. Now, I mentioned the missing baryons. You certainly, many of you are familiar with that. This is just one of the many ways you can show the fact that there are missing baryons in galaxies. This is the baryonic tool with Fisher, actually extended to the scale of galaxy clusters, baryonic mass versus circular velocity. And this is what you should have if you were capturing the cosmic fraction at all scales, from low mass galaxies up to clusters. And of course, at cluster scales, you have basically the cosmic baryon fraction, but as you go to lower masses, right, the group scales, a few hundred kilometers per second, you start to be deficient. And here I circle the scale of the Milky Way or so. So halos around 10 to the 12, and clearly you have a deficiency there, and then it gets even larger when you go to lower masses. Now, there's always been two ways of addressing this in the literature since long ago. One way is to say these baryons are not inside the virial radius. They are outside the virial radius. They are part of the so-called warm-hot intergalactic medium. The other way to address this is to say maybe at least a fraction of these baryons are actually inside the virial radius, but they are not seen, they're not detected. Because what you see here, down to from this mass scale downward, is only the sum of cold baryons and stars, right? For galaxies, that's what we typically put on the Bolyai-Tully-Fisher ratio. There's no hot baryons, nothing with a temperature larger than a few times 10 to the 4 is in this plot up to this scale. Of course, for clusters instead, you include the hot gas, which is the dominant component. Now, I will focus on the Milky Way mass scale, and the real reason is because these are the kind of simulations that we are doing, so that's what I can use to address this topic. But if you want to connect it to the broader picture, of course, we can say that the Milky Way mass scale is an interesting scale because galaxies of a few times 10 to the 10 stellar mass are really at the transition in the famous galaxy bimodality relation, and they're also near the transition for the switch between the cold and hot mode accretion. And also, if you look at it from the point of view of the stellar to halo mass relation, they also are near the peak, so near the maximum efficiency of conversion of baryons into stars. So they are an interesting place to study the baryonic phases. And I think the hot corona is connected to all these things that can give us some information on all these things. A brief history of how theorists have tried to address the problem of the formation and the properties of this hot X-ray emitting gas around spirals. So this goes back, of course, to the foundations, to predicting it as a consequence of collapse into a dark matter halo, so the gravitational heating would generate such a hot phase. And then people in this room actually did a lot of work more than 10 years ago on making an important point that if you just follow the simple accretion of gas, the temperature you expect if you don't remove baryons by any mechanism, you expect to have a hot, a very massive corona, which will give you a very high luminosity, an X-ray luminosity of more than 10 to the 42 X per second. Now, this has never been detected around spiral galaxies, so this was an argument early on to say that maybe baryonic outflows were actually pushing this gas out so that you would not see that. So it was also an early evidence for feedback, if you want. Now, simulations through years have tried to address the problem and just measure what they were seeing in the earlier galaxy formation calculations. And the bottom line is that all the simulations done in the 2000s or so were also finding roughly these super high luminosities, which are, of course, not detected, because the ones that we detect now are at most 10 to the 40. Okay, so these are almost two orders of magnitude higher than the luminosity of the halos that we now can detect around spiral galaxies. And the reason of this discrepancy was exactly what was pointed out already by Andrew and others, that if you don't have feedback, you collapse all the baryons, essentially all the cosmic baryon fraction is locked into the halo. Part of it makes stars, and the rest is heated into this hot corona. Now, these early simulations had some thermal feedback, to be frank. So they were heating the gas very gently, and so they were doing something to the temperature. But others were not doing anything, were completely avoiding feedback, and they were claiming that when they were doing that, the luminosity was going down. But of course, it was, you know, an incorrect way to solve the problem, because there was overcooling, which was actually locking even more baryons into stars, so you would have less baryons in the hot mode, but you would overpredict stars by even a larger factor. And so nobody was able to have a reasonable constraint on the hot mode, which was consistent with the no detections, and also a reasonable stellar mass. And then things got better. And then if you proceed with later simulations, then a few years ago, different groups began to make predictions out of the simulations that were not as crazy as before. The X-ray luminosity went down by a lot. In this work, we had finally a halo that was consistent with the no detections. And the reason was because it was twofold. First of all, that only a fraction of the gas was actually, of the cosmic variant fraction was making up the corona. Another fraction was ejected by hot flow. So you were only locking a fraction of the cosmic variants inside the hot phase. In addition, the heating provided by FIDO was generating a flatter profile, which would depress the X-ray luminosity. Okay, so by removing some baryons, not all of them, just some of them, and heating thermodynamically the gas, different works were starting to obtain more reasonable matches with the no detections. Okay, now there's more recent work that compare also different types of numerical techniques, focusing on the scales where you actually detect halos now, so these big spiral galaxies or even ellipticals with M star of 10 to the 11 or so. And the comparison was actually relatively successful, but with some discrepancies between, for example, a repoint gadget in this case. Now, so we looked at again at this problem, with five very high res zoom-ins. One is the old Iris run, which is the one that gave this reasonable prediction for the X-ray luminosity in the previous slide. And others are remakes of Iris with different choice of parameters for star formation and feedback, and also simulations with different initial conditions, but the same mass scale. The mass scale is this one, which is just slightly below 10 to the 12. Okay, so for all of them is the same. The remakes of Iris, like the original one, have a very quiet merging history. The last major merger are happening at redshift around 3. And this new type of initial conditions for which we have now one run only so far, which is called the Venus set, they have very different ICs because they have a very active merging history. The last major merger happens at redshift 0.9, and there are many, many mergers up to there. So the resolution is relatively good. I think now that there's one of the fire zoom-ins that's actually better than this, but until 1 year ago, this was sort of the state of the art in resolution. Now, there is other papers in which we summarize all the properties of these galaxies, and this is one that Alexander, the PhD student who was leading most of this work, has published a few months ago, where we studied other things, angular momentum, disk and bulge build-up, and so on. And you can see two of these examples, the original Eris and Venus, the one with very active merging history. You can see a much clearer disk in the distribution of angular momentum in the quiescent Eris case than in the one with the active merging history, but both of them are dominated by a disk with, which you see as the nearly circular orbit peak in the circularity distribution. Now, I'm not talking about any of the other analysis that's been done, but the point to take out from here is that these simulations are reasonable in terms of the properties of galaxies that they produce, so then we started looking at them to study the gas outside the disk. Now, if you compare these five zoom-ins in terms of fractional baryons inside a VIR or two times or three times a VIR, this is what you get. So you always have some outflows that produce a lower fraction of baryons inside a VIR compared to the cosmic. So this is in fraction of the cosmic baryon fraction. But you can see that typically you have about two-thirds of the baryon still locked inside the halo, even a bit more than that, depending on which case you pick. This is the run with also AGN feedback added. The difference is almost negligible because in this model, at least, feedback doesn't have a big effect on large scales. Now you can see the buildup of the hot phase pretty early in all the simulations. As you can look at these temperature maps, already at redshift 3, and in some cases even before that, you clearly have a hot atmosphere developing and going out to fairly large radius. This is not saying anything about what is causing that. Of course, it will be a combination of many things: gravitational heating, mergers, and eventually also feedback. And this is what we want to understand better, you know, how the different effects play together. This one, this run here, E2K, is a run in which the feedback parameters have been boosted to get more feedback, essentially, to get stronger outflows, to match better the M star MLO over time. And you can see, as you expect, that you put more energy through more feedback, and this has an effect also on the development of odd phase, which is clearly more prominent at redshift 3 than in the case with more moderate feedback. Okay? This one is the one with the different initial condition, which has more mergers, but has also a delayed formation because the last major merger is late. And you can see that the hot phase develops later. So a redshift 3 is just beginning to develop. It's just concentrated near the galaxy. Now, the interesting thing, if you look at the budget of the different phases, the first thing to note is that if you define warm and cold gas below 10 to the 5, warm hot gas between 10 to the 5 and 10 to the 6, and then the hot X-ray emitting gas larger than 10 to the 6, then the dominant one is clearly this one here, the warm hot, so between 10 to the 5 and 10 to the 6. That is already telling you that not only you have removed some baryons through outflows, but of the baryons that you have kept inside the halo and not turned into stars or not accreted onto the galaxy, only a fraction will be X-ray luminous. And it's not the largest fraction, actually. Okay? The larger fraction will be in this colder temperature range, where maybe at the tail, at the high temperature tail, you have some contribution to the soft X-rays, but it's certainly marginal. So in the end, you're left with about, as you can see, 6 times 10 to the 9, 7 times 10 to the 9 solar masses of gas inside the halo, which will be X-ray luminous for sure. Okay? These are the stellar masses of the galaxy that are similar to the Milky Way. So you can compute the X-ray luminosities of the different galaxies, and what you get is that in the moderate feedback cases, the typical numbers you get out are between 10 to the 39 and 10 to the 40, which is consistent with a recent determination of the X-ray luminosity of the Milky Way by Miller and Bregman using XMM Newton absorption and emission in oxygen 7 and 8. Now, you look at the extreme feedback run, the E2K run, this gets to a large result, 10 to the 42, which is off from the Milky Way, but it's also off in the sense that even the other galaxies which we have X-ray luminous halos detected are not that luminous, even if they are bigger than the Milky Way. So this is clearly problematic, if you want. The strong feedback run is not consistent with the data, at least in this comparison with the hot phase. We also looked at the cost-halos comparison, but this is not interesting in this context because they don't characterize the phases in the same way we are doing it for the most part of the talk. Yeah?
In the strong feedback cases, the luminosity is so much higher because of just hot gas that's close to the
galaxy? There's a number of... So you have a higher density, really. So the higher... And you will see that now here. A higher electron density. The hot halo is also more compact, that's why it's denser. And it's also more matter-rich, so that also contributes. So there's several effects that contribute to boost up the luminosity. And you can see that here, what we have here is a set of different curves, but if you look at the solid lines, the blue line and the green line, so these are just the two runs. One is the original areas with moderate feedback, the green line, and this is the one with strong feedback, the E2K. This is electron density. You can see what I was telling you here, the profile of the electron density goes up much steeper towards the center, and it's almost an order of magnitude higher than the moderate feedback run. What we did here is also we compared with a model profiles that follow the same procedure that Miller and Bregman followed in their study of the oxygen 7-8 absorption from the Milky Way halo. I'm not going into detail. If people are interested, you can ask me afterwards or even after the talk. The bottom line is that if you follow the same procedure and derive the electron density from the oxygen 7 absorption, exactly the same way they do it, okay? What they do is they try to fit the data with a spherical beta model, and that's what we did, and we modified the model according to the fact that we have a profile in metallicity and ionization, which they don't have because they assume a fixed ionization and metallicity. And these are these dashed lines, you know, the model reproduction with the effect of metallicity and ionization built in are these dashed lines that you get for the two simulations. So taking the profiles of ionization and metallicity from the simulations, red and blue dashed line. And you can see then the second point of this plot that if I compare ARIES raw data with ARIES model Ala, Miller, and Bregman, they are quite consistent with each other. Whereas in the other case, in the E2K, in the strong feedback run, they're also very inconsistent with each other. Okay, so that's another evidence to say that the strong feedback run doesn't match the Milky Way data. Now, the odd phase has a very clear property in all these simulations that soon after it starts to build up, so soon after redshift 3 or so, it is developing a very clear characteristic radius. So it starts to be confined in a way. And that's what you can see here. And we are now trying to understand this characteristic radius may be related to the boundary condition between the hot and the warm hot phase. The warm hot phase is more extended, goes out to larger radii. And it seems like there is a kind of pressure equilibrium condition that ensures this characteristic radius for the hot phase. These are the I'm just showing the last two or three slides of the part that is more like in progress. And you can see, as you expect, if you look at outflows, velocity of winds versus escape speed, the strong feedback run early on has extremely efficient outflows that go out to much larger speed than escape speed. The other ones, they have moderate winds. And now, if you look at how the results compare with one of the interesting thresholds from galaxy formation theory, which is the transition between cold and hot mode, that's the interesting thing that I wanted to show you, is that the buildup of the hot halo, or let's say the time at which the hot halo reaches about sort of the final radius, which is typically between 60% and 80% of the virial radius, happens earlier, you can see here, it happens earlier than the time at which the halo mass reaches the threshold that should give you the switch between the cold and hot mode. This is the Keres et al. Threshold, and this is taken from the Decker and Birnbaum paper, the gray band. And you see you have to go up to about 2 times 10 to the 11 or so. That's the most conservative result from Keres et al. But this happens at redshift 2, or a redshift slightly less than 3 in this case. But you see that already at redshift 3.5, even 4, the hot phase in both Eris, Venus, and even marginal E2K are about 80% of the virial radius in extent. So if you build an extended atmosphere well before you go to the cold hot mode transition. This for us is, I'm almost done here. This for us is evidence, even if it's not conclusive, so it's still ongoing, the analysis, that feedback is playing a role in somehow accelerating the generation of the hot phase, at least. I'm not saying that it plays a role in generating it 100%, because of course you have gravitational heating and you have mergers and so on, but it seems like it's giving a head start that you would not have without it. And again, if you look at the cold filaments cross-section versus the halo virial radius cross-section, which sometimes is also used to look at the switch between cold and hot mode, this cross-section remains relatively small relative to the halo, which means the cold flows can penetrate down to redshift 1, but the hot mode builds at redshift 3. So even this is telling you the hot mode is not just related to the gravitational potential well growth and to the cold filament behavior. Metallicity also tells you the hot mode is also always the highest metallicity component, which suggests again that feedback is playing a role in building it up. And I will stop here by saying that because we've done other types of quantitative analysis that I don't have time to show here, but none of them is actually telling us very unambiguously to what extent feedback is actually playing a role. We see evidence that it is playing a role, but it's hard to actually single out quantitatively the contribution. We are now rerunning some of these simulations without feedback from a time just before when we see the hot mode developing in the standard runs. And you can see in this case, this is the Venus run, rerun from redshift 5 without feedback. a redshift 2.68, that the feedback round clearly has a much less prominent hot phase. But unfortunately, I can tell you that as you wait longer, the difference will become smaller. I mean, it's probably expected because the halo grows in mass, and therefore gravitational heating becomes progressively more important. But we don't have a conclusive picture yet of the quantitative role of feedback, although there's a strong indication in favor of that. And I stop here.
So I'm a little bit confused because it seemed like you started out saying in the absence of feedback, just the accretion shocks would heat things up to a few million degrees. So we're going to turn on feedback, spread the gas out to lower density, reduce the X-rays. But then at the end here, you've got less million degree gas in the no feedback simulation. So is just this because this is lower mass?
No, you know, this is actually 2.68.
So it's just early.
Yeah, it's just early. I mean, I'm just showing that as you restart the runs without feedback, luckily, as we were hoping, you see a difference.
Yeah.
But I also said that as we are moving on with the analysis, we see that at later times the differences become smaller. And that's exactly because of what you said, because as the halo grows, at least I think that that's the reason, as the halo grows, the gravitational heating inevitably is starting to play a role. But I think that even if in the end it comes out to, yes, feedback has a role, but it's not a major role, it's still interesting to see that at high redshift, it makes a big difference. So it's more maybe interesting for high redshift galaxy formation. But I think it's still very interesting to understand.
And then a couple of slides back, I thought you said the winds can't move the gas past the virial radius, but I didn't understand why.
No, where? Here? Not sure. Not sure where do you refer. I will talk about the confinement radius, perhaps. Or
no, it was actually on your slide, just a couple before the end.
A couple before the end. Let's see. This was the metallicity, and then there's a slide here on the winds. That's just a measurement of the velocity. It's, of course, azimuthally average, so it's not a detailed measurement. We have also anisotropic analysis of this, but the velocity of the wind versus VSK, that's probably what you were referring to. That it's showing that... Yeah, we can talk about that later.
Technical question. Yeah. So this high-resolution simulation always try to simulate Milky Way system.
Yeah.
When you set the initial condition, do you take the satellite population into consideration?
Sorry.
Especially Milky Way have RMC and SMC, there's two pretty big satellites.
Yeah. No, I mean, at least not us. There are people who do constrained simulations where they try to actually reproduce the configuration of structure in the local group. But in this case, we only choose a halo with a virial mass around the 10 to the 12 mass range, and we specify a certain merging history. These are the two criteria, the mass of the halo and the merging history. We don't add extra criteria like having a certain configuration of the satellite. Simon, yes.
So coming back to the previous point, and the fact that you don't get the buildup of a hot halo at early times, but it comes later in when you switch off the feedback. And that's surely that's a consequence of a competition between two effects, because this is expected even in a very simple model, just because at early times the cosmological density is higher and so the cooling rates are shorter. So mm-hmm. if you calculate the rate, the ratio of the cooling time behind a shock to the age of the universe at high redshift, cooling time is much shorter, and so the shock can't sustain itself. By the time you get to low redshift, it can. So probably if you look at your halo here, the actual post-shock temperature doesn't change all that much in principle.
It's the cooling
redshift,
time.
But the post-shock density changes a lot.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, it's not something that you don't expect. The interest here is more to quantify the timing of the buildup, how that depends on the effect of feedback.
Why wouldn't that be in the Karas et al. Models then?
We'll be in the Karas et al. Models. So, well, unfortunately, I missed the time, so I missed the early. So you think you have a contradiction with Karas et al.?
I don't. So that's a good, it's a good question. So I think, and again, this is still ongoing, so I don't want to, you know, make a definitive statement on this, but the things that we're taking away from here so far is that the current simulations, all of them, have, as we all know, stronger feedback than models of several years ago. And so I believe that we probably have an earlier build-up of the hot phase, which pushes down also a bit the threshold that you have in Karas et al. Because we are using stronger feedback. So even what I call moderate feedback runs, I think they're stronger feedback runs compared to what Karas et al. Were using almost 10 years ago. So I think that that's going to be the bottom line. But we don't have a demonstration of this yet.
Okay, thank you, Lucia.